WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, a tribute to opera singer Beverly Sills by our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz. And we listen back to our 1985 interview with Sills. She died earlier this week. Also, the new film Rescue Dawn by director Werner Herzog is a dramatic retelling of the story of his 1997 documentary Little Dieter Needs to Fly. It chronicles the jungle ordeal of Dieter Dengler, the only U.S. pilot to have successfully escaped from a North Vietnamese-controlled prison. Herzog tells us about the real Dengler, and film critic David Edelstein reviews Rescue Dawn. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. You didn't have to know opera to know Beverly Sills. The American soprano died earlier this week from lung cancer at the age of 78. Most Americans knew her from her TV appearances, with Carol Burnett in The Muppets, as a guest host on Johnny Carson's Tonight Show, and from her own talk show. When she retired from singing, she ran the New York City Opera and became chair of Lincoln Center and the Metropolitan Opera. But none of this would matter if she hadn't been an extraordinary singer. In a few minutes, we'll hear an interview Terry recorded with Beverly Sills. But first, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz shares some thoughts about her career.
Beverly Sills was the best-loved American singer of her generation. Her nickname, Bubbles, tells a large part of the story. She was exuberant, irrepressible, effervescent, smart, and funny. And at the height of her 25-year career as an opera singer, she had one of the most beautiful voices in the world. Her fans called her Beverly Trills. Later, some of her critics called her Beverly Shrills. I heard her a lot when she was the reigning diva of Sarah Caldwell's Opera Company of Boston from the early 1960s into the mid-70s. She was the company workhorse who sang a wide repertory that embraced Mozart, early 19th century bel canto, French Romanticism, Verdi and Puccini, and contemporary avant-garde. I can still see her flaming mop of red hair sticking out from behind the barricades in Luigi Nono's 12-tone anti-war opera Intolleranza. In Offenbach's Tales of Hoffman, she sang all four leading soprano parts, and she always seemed to be having a good time. I'll never forget her cracking up on stage in The Barber of Seville when the note she was supposed to drop from her balcony fluttered into the orchestra pit. In one production, she was singing with a tenor who was so bad he refused to take a curtain call, but Sills literally dragged him out from the wings for his bow. Critic Michael Steinberg called her the kind of woman who actually catches the bouquets that are thrown at her across orchestra pits and footlights. 1966 was her landmark year. In Boston, she sang the lead in Caldwell's dazzling production of an 18th century rarity, Rameau's Hippolyte et Aricy, opposite an unknown young tenor named Placido Domingo. Sills astounded the audience with the effortless beauty and agility of her coloratura. Shortly after this, at the New York City Opera, her other operatic home, in a revival of another 18th century opera, Handel's Julius Caesar, she made headlines as the witty, seductive, self-knowing Cleopatra. After years of remaining underappreciated, she became, as they say, an overnight sensation.
Woo!
My one regret about Sills's career is that she had the chance to change the history of opera performance, reviving a lost repertoire of Baroque operas the way Maria Callas in the 1950s rediscovered and shed new light on the forgotten early 19th century operas of Bellini, Rossini, and Donizetti. Or she could have won a whole new audience for operetta, some of her recordings of which are unsurpassed. But Sills wanted to be an opera star more than an exploring artist. She got what she wanted, and at her best she was a marvel. Her uninhibited sincerity could really touch your heart. Here's one of my favorite Sills recordings, Mozart's heavenly Ruhe sanft, Rest Peacefully, from his unfinished opera Zaida. Despite her personal tragedies, two children with disabilities, her daughter was deaf and couldn't hear her mother sing. Beverly Sills seemed a steamroller, as her friend violinist Isaac Stern called her, someone who would never let up or lose her sense of humor. She retired from singing at the age of 51. She told an interviewer, "I wanted people to say, 'You left too soon,' not 'You left too late.'" She became a major arts administrator and a vigorous spokesperson for the arts. Last year, she served as the delightful host for the new Live Met closed-circuit telecasts in movie theaters around the world. No one else ever made a serious and demanding endeavor like opera seem like so much fun.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches English at the University of Massachusetts Boston. In 1985, Terry Gross talked with Beverly Sills about her career and her life. It was 5 years after she'd retired from performing and 5 years into her tenure as the general director of the New York City Opera.
You're one of the few singers of your generation who made a career by studying and performing in America. Were you told when you were getting started that you'd really better go to Europe if you expected to really have a singing career?
Well, yes. Actually, I received a Fulbright, which I didn't accept after going through all the business of making the tapes and presentations. There simply wasn't enough money for me to just take off and go to Europe. My mother was widowed. I had two brothers in school, becoming doctors under the GI Bill. But there was very limited funds. My mother was alone. I just felt that I was going to have to make it here. I just didn't feel I had the luxury of going abroad. And something inside me made me resent the fact that I couldn't make a living singing opera in my own country.
You didn't sing at the Met until 1975.
Right.
Why do you think it took them that long to invite you to sing there? Do you think it had to do with your lack of European
performance? No, it had to do with Rudolf Bing, period. Mm-hmm. I said that I would never sing at the Met until Mr. Bing retired. And the day after he retired, I signed the contract with Gendler, and that was that.
What was it between you and he?
Well, it started out, of course, with the idea that he really didn't feel that the American artist could add to the prestige of the Metropolitan Opera. It is true that he was there in glorious times when there was Tibaldi and Delmonico and Corelli and Bastianini and, you know, so who needed the American? He had a great wealth of European artists to choose from. He also wrote a book about me, and about me he wrote, "How could a girl from Brooklyn know anything about singing the Queens of Donizetti?" It's interesting. Why should a girl from Brooklyn know less than, let's say, a lady from Spain? Or, I mean, English queens are English queens. It was just an attitude he had. We have since, you know, become very close friends. He had a radio program and invited me to go on it, which I thought took a lot of courage on his part. And we found we had same kind of humor. And he announced on the radio that I was his biggest mistake and that his greatest regret was not that I didn't sing at the Met because I proved that I didn't need the Met, but that we could have been friends for 20 years and that he regrets.
One of the turning points in your career was when you sang the role of Cleopatra in Julius Caesar, and it was critically acclaimed.
Yeah, that was the turning point.
Now, you had told Julius Riddell, the head of the New York City Opera, that if he hired someone outside the company for the role of Cleopatra, as he had been considering doing, that you were going to quit.
Yes.
Did it ever dawn on you that he might have said, well, then goodbye?
Yes. Oh, he said to me, you're not going to quit. I said, yes, I am. Well, he said, how will that accomplish your singing Cleopatra? And I said, I will do my first New York recital at Carnegie Hall. Peter, my husband, has offered to give it to me as a present. And I will sing all five of the Cleopatra arias that are in your version. And he burst out laughing. I said to him, Julius, take someone inside the company, not me, and I won't open my mouth. But going outside implies there's nobody within who can do it. And that simply isn't true. And it's just too demeaning. I'll never fight you on taking another soprano who's with us. That's you're the director of the company. You're supposed to take the one that you feel does it best. But to go outside means there's nobody here who can do it. And that's just a lie. So I don't accept it.
Had you ever done anything like that before?
No.
Give an ultimatum like that?
No, but you understand, in 1966, I was already 37 years old. I wasn't a young singer. In the past, when I had first begun, I didn't have financial security. It was hard for me to walk away from any job that paid me anything. I was a married woman. My husband was a very successful businessman, and it didn't worry me that I might not have enough money. My mother was cared for. Both my brothers were doctors already. So, you know, life was moving on. And singing was not the be-all and end-all in my life. I had my husband and my family. I had a very good life outside of the opera house, so I didn't feel desperate. And I was never terribly ambitious. I never dreamed this career would happen. I wanted to sing because I loved to sing. I really did. I couldn't wait to get to the theater to sing. But when I made that ultimatum, I made it with the idea that, yes, he could say, look, that's my decision. I also made it from a very secure feeling of knowing that at that moment I was doing all the parts in Hoffman for him, Donna Anna, the Queen of the Night, Constanza, and the Abduction from the Seraglio. You don't replace me that easily. You have somebody who every fourth night can walk in and do four of the most difficult things in the repertoire. You don't just dismiss her lightly. And coming up were a tremendous number of projects that required my capabilities, such as they were, and he knew it. But in the case of the Cleopatra, it was the opening night of the new theater, the opening night of its first grand opera season. I felt I had stuck with the company. I'd been with it 11 years at that point. I just felt that opening night should have been mine, particularly since the role was made for my voice.
Do you think you sang especially well that first night?
Yes, I think I did. I think the excitement caught on. I think Tregel and I were at our very, very best. I looked up at one point and I thought, my God, he's a singing Gielgud. You know, it was an extraordinary moment. I think that opening night, nobody could have touched us.
Beverly Sills speaking with Terry Gross in 1985. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1985 interview with Beverly Sills, who died earlier this week.
Throughout your career in opera, you have been known as not only an excellent singer, but as an excellent actress as well. And I'd really like for you to tell a story that you relay in your memoir about working with Pavarotti and your fear that after he took an aria, he was going to bow and like break with the role momentarily, and you didn't want that to happen.
No, well, you know, we had different training, really. When you grow up with the New York City Opera, which is a repertory company, you find yourself playing cameo roles one night and four nights later you're the leading lady. So there really isn't time to think about curtain calls and bows. Luciano is a very warm individual. That's not a play that he acts out when he's on stage. I think the hanky came later, but the ebullience and the outpouring comes from the man himself. And it is a kind of love affair he has with the public. And when they applaud a lot, he just likes to acknowledge and say thank you right away. I did go to see him and beg him not to do that. And I said to him, you know, everything we do will bring the house down if we do it well, because Bellini is one showstopper after another. And it's disconcerting, and I got that crazy mad scene coming up. I've got to start the character right from the beginning, and she's such a elusive girl anyhow. It's not like Lucia that is, you know, builds to a terrific, terrific madness. This is just kind of wacky. And I said to him, you know, let's not bow. And he said, I can promise. And we had this big duet ending in a great big embrace with our heads in each other's necks, sort of. And the house came down, and suddenly they were still applauding, and he said to me, one little bow, Bevelina. And I said, no. So he bit me in the neck, and of course I pulled back, and there we were. It certainly looked to the audience as if we were bowing.
Are there any conventions in opera that you think are really pretensions of opera that you'd like to see stripped away, like the hanky, for instance?
Yes. Yeah, I'd like to see all pretensions in opera stripped away. I'd like to see a much more naturalistic approach to the acting. Corelli had it. He knew how to lean back against the wall and sing the third act aria in Tosca, just by putting his hands in his pockets. I hate operatic poses. I think we shouldn't be afraid to turn our backs on the audience while we're singing, if it's a natural movement to make. I think we shouldn't hesitate to sing an ugly tone if the word we're saying is an ugly one that should be spit out and not prettily voiced. And I'd like to see lighting much more naturalistic. If it's a hot summer Mediterranean day, I'd like you to feel that the people are sweaty. It's a given that I'd like to have beautiful singing. I mean, there is no opera without a beautiful voice. But for me, that's only about 60% of the evening. The other 40 is to touch me emotionally and intellectually.
When you look back on your career in music now from the vantage point of being the director of the New York City Opera, are there any things that you really wish you could have done differently or want to change?
Nothing. There isn't even a role I left undone. It's funny. I would have perhaps liked to have sung more in Europe, but with my children, that was impossible to put so much distance between us. Other than that, can't think of a single thing I'd have done differently.
Beverly Sills speaking with Terry Gross in 1985. She died earlier this week at the age of 78. Her farewell performance was on October 27, 1980, after 25 years performing with the New York City Opera. She ended the evening with her rendition of the Portuguese folk song, Tell Me Why. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Please. Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Classics edition of The Federalist, papers by Hamilton, Madison, and Jay, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, helping states protect public safety, hold offenders accountable, and control the cost of corrections at pewpublicsafety.org. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting health insurance coverage for all America's children, on the web at covertheuninsured.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The new film Rescue Dawn is a dramatic retelling of the true story of Dieter Dengler, the only U.S. pilot to have successfully escaped from a North Vietnamese-controlled prison. Coming up, we hear from director Werner Herzog, who first visited Dengler's story in the 1997 documentary Little Dieter Needs to Fly. And David Edelstein reviews Rescue Dawn. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. For more than 30 years, German-born film director Werner Herzog has been making feature films and documentaries, and for the first time he's made one of each on the same subject. His new film, and his first Hollywood feature, Rescue Dawn, recounts the grueling ordeal in the Laotian jungle of Navy pilot Dieter Dengler, who was the subject of Herzog's 1997 documentary, Little Dieter Needs to Fly. In a moment, we'll hear Terry's interview with Herzog about the documentary. First, David Edelstein has a review of Rescue Dawn.
Dieter Dengler reportedly wasn't satisfied with Werner Herzog's documentary about his life, Little Dieter Needs to Fly. He liked it, and he should have. It put him on a pedestal. The 1997 film recounted the German-American Dengler's experience as a pilot in the early days of the Vietnam War. He was shot down on a secret bombing raid over Laos and held by a ragtag group of enemy soldiers in near deer hunter conditions. But Dengler didn't go into detail about his life in that makeshift jungle prison camp because, he has said, he didn't want to be ungenerous toward his fallen comrades. And so he felt the story was incomplete. Herzog agreed, hence Rescue Dawn, a dramatization. Seeing it, I had a hunch Herzog always wanted to make his own Deer Hunter, his own story of wartime cruelty and survival. His favorite theme is front and center, a man tested against nature, his sanity more precarious than his body. But this time, you don't get Herzog's loitering camera, his heavy Teutonic musings, or the usual self-dramatizing protagonist. The movie is lean and wiry, the artistry artfully camouflaged. Christian Bale is Dieter. He's a Brit playing an Americanized German, and his accent falls somewhere in the North Atlantic, between Iceland and Brooklyn. But Bale catches Dengler's restlessness, the bravery as much the result of impatience as nobility of soul. In both films, Dengler says he needed to fly when he caught a glimpse of an American pilot in the cockpit of a plane that happened to be strafing his German city. What would a psychologist call that? Identifying with the enemy? It's so outlandish, you can understand why it would engage Herzog, who made his reputation spinning sagas of men who strive to the point of madness to meet and conquer what oppresses them. Herzog wastes little time in Vietnam, where Dengler hopes to partake in Saigon's fabled licentiousness. The young pilot is promptly dropping bombs on Laotian villages and promptly shot down by anti-aircraft fire. It's here, as he flees the Viet Cong, that the movie bursts into life amid the deep greens of the jungle, with its absurdly huge leaves providing cover for the pursued, pursuers, and occasional poisonous snake. Dankler tries to merge with that landscape, yet at the same time to be spotted by American air patrols. The scenes after his capture are like nothing I've seen. He's marched through a village and waves hi to the men, women, and children he was bombing, and they follow, laughing, as he's dragged behind a truck. He won't sign a denunciation of the country that gave him wings, so he's taken deep in the jungle and thrown into a shack with a half dozen South Vietnamese and American wrecks. He barely hesitates before planning an escape, which a fellow prisoner, played by Steve Zahn, finds dubious.
Without water, you won't survive more than 2 days out there. Without water, your tracks will be visible for even more. The jungle is the prison. Don't you get it? Hey, when does the rainy season start?
5 months, maybe six.
I can't wait that long. Hey, listen. Let's say you do survive the jungle and lack water. There's 6 guards posted during the day.
Yeah, that is during the day. I'm going at night.
As their fear and hunger grows, Zahn's character burrows into himself, while another prisoner, played by Jeremy Davies, sprouts dementia like werewolf hair. The men make charts, learn how to slip in and out of shackles, and trace the movements of their captors. Their primal dependence on one another, and at times their primal repulsion, is exacerbated by their isolation. You can feel their sense of dwindling options in that shrouded landscape, and their starvation in a country denuded of crops by American bombs. There are episodes in Little Dieter Needs to Fly I wish had been included in its fictional counterpart, as well as details of Dengler's childhood that explain his uncanny stamina. I even recommend seeing the movies back to back, with a bowl of rice in between, to slake the sympathetic hunger. Rescue Dawn is such a confident piece of storytelling, it made me wish that Herzog had gone Hollywood earlier. He has a fascinating body of work, but he might have made some great old-fashioned adventure movies without selling out his sensibilities. Maybe at the young age of 65, he still can.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Coming up, we hear Terry's interview with Werner Herzog about his documentary based on Dieter Dengler's story. This is Fresh Air. Filmmaker Werner Herzog is one of the directors who reestablished Germany as a major force in cinema after its movie industry was decimated by Hitler and World War II. Herzog was born in 1942. Like the Dieter Dengler story told in his new film Rescue Dawn, many of Herzog's movies have been about physical and emotional extremes, often involving enigmatic characters struggling against seemingly impossible odds. His film Aguirre, the Wrath of God is about a mad Spanish conquistador. Fitzcarraldo follows a man obsessed with building an opera house in the jungle. In 1998, Terry spoke to Herzog about his first film based on Dieter Dengler, the documentary Little Dieter Needs to Fly. Dengler was a German-born U.S. Navy pilot who was shot down during the war in Vietnam, then imprisoned and tortured in Laos. In this scene from the documentary, Dengler describes the day he escaped.
I ran out in the open. Nobody came from this side except the guards. They're running in my direction. I must have heard or seen the other guys. And this big shootout started. All of a sudden, the bullets were flying. Somehow we had miscalculated. Somebody had a rifle in there. I had this submachine gun in my hand. I'd never shot one before. When I pulled the trigger, it practically flew out of my hand. It raised up like that, and this allowed them to close this distance real quick. They came within 2 or 3 feet for me. The moron, one of the guys, had a machete in his hand. He came within 4 or 5 feet. I shot him through the hip. It lifted him up. It threw him down to the ground. Next thing I'm looking up, he's getting up again. He still had the machete. He's still coming at me. Of course, this time I couldn't miss. He was right 2 or 3 feet in front of me. I couldn't believe it. I didn't have a scratch. There's 5 dead guards laying on the ground. 2 of them got away. They ran a zigzag pattern. They got in the jungle. I knew then, right then and there, they would get help and we had to get out of there. Where was Dwayne? I saw him behind this bush over here. He had vomited. I yelled to him, Dwayne, let's get out here. Let's get out of here. We took off. We ran down between this kitchen. We ran amongst those dead guys laying on the ground. And it was very important because our shoes were tied together in a bundle. We're hanging on this hut over here. The shoes we needed in the jungle, but when we got there, they were already taken. The other guys must have taken them, run off with them. And then Dwayne and I, we had no choice but to turn around. Barefoot, we ran into the jungle. Now, of the 7 of us that escaped, I was the only one that came out alive. The other one disappeared in the jungle, and nobody ever heard from them again.
Dieter Dengler's escape was filled with hellish adventures, including surviving a monsoon without any protection. Terry asked Herzog how he thought Dengler was changed by his experience.
I do believe that he was not very much changed because he had a very difficult and hard childhood, and that somehow linked me together with him immediately. Both of us grew up in tiny rural villages in rural areas, remote from everything. We didn't know what TV was, what a telephone was. I made my first phone call at the age of 17. And he knew hunger, and he knew all the hardships of growing up as a post-war child. And I do believe that he was extremely well prepared, better than anyone else that I would know for an ordeal of that nature. He had all the qualities that make America so wonderful, the qualities of self-reliance, courage, spirit of some sort of a frontier, and all those things.
You brought him back to the jungle and had him simulate some of the scenes that he lived through when he was in the prison camp. It seems like it was almost masochistic on his part to agree to that.
Not really, because he felt very much at ease with this whole thing. Fact is that he has been at least 15 times before we made the film back to the jungle, back to Southeast Asia. He loves Asian people. He loves the qualities, the human qualities of his former enemies. And that may be the only change, to come back to the previous question. He changed his attitude about the opponent, about the enemy, the Vietnamese, the Laotians. He had no concept of who they were. I mean, he started in the war very, very early in 1965, where nobody really talked about Vietnam, and he thought it would be over in 3 weeks, that they just had to assist some South Vietnamese generals to stop a few insurgents from the north. And in his first mission over North Vietnam, he was actually shot down after 40 minutes. So he didn't really capture what the war was all about. Once he was down on the ground, the entire country was not an abstract grid on a map anymore. It was all of a sudden, it was filled with voices, with human beings, with people who were starving, people who were under pressure of air attacks and all this. And almost immediately he started to change his attitude, to understand that there were real people down there, real suffering down there, real death down there.
He seems to be very obsessive in his descriptions of the past, obsessed with what is required to survive. And he's almost a survivalist now. I mean, you have him saying that he keeps hundreds of pounds of grains in his house in case of emergency because he knows what it's like to be without food. And watching the movie, I kept wondering, was this guy really obsessive before his imprisonment, or did he become obsessive as a result of his imprisonment? And I know that you are very interested in obsession and are probably pretty obsessive yourself, so I was wondering if you had any thoughts about that.
I wouldn't really call him obsessive.
No.
Of course, he has been changed by all these experiences, and he feels much safer to have 1,100 pounds of rice and 1,000 yeah. pounds of flour under his kitchen floor dug into the ground. Sure, that is understandable. And he has developed certain safeguards. He's a very wholesome man, a very healthy human being. Sometimes he, I have the feeling he's hiding his wounds, and he's hiding the terror behind some very casual remarks. I would, for example, ask him in private, Dieter, don't you have any nightmares of that time? Is there nothing left? And he says, oh, that was the fun part of my life. So we can only sense that there's still some open wounds within the man, but he's not collapsing and not struggling for his sanity and all those things that you might have seen among many of the Vietnam veterans who came home and who were innerly destroyed.
How come you've been making so many documentaries? I know you've made documentaries on and off through your career, but it seems to be, well, exclusively what you're doing now.
It's not the exclusive thing I'm doing now. Once in a while, I stage operas. I love to live and breathe and work with music. But it is true, in the last couple of years, I've only done documentaries, and that was a development, a deep question about filmmaking, probably about writing or art in general. What constitutes truth in, for example, a great poem? When you read Robert Frost and you have some very deep feeling about it, and all of a sudden you have this sensation there is some deep, inexplicable and mysterious truth in it. And the same thing happens in movies. And it does not happen, strangely enough, in the most of the documentaries that you would see on television. You would not find it in the so-called cinema vérité, which can only scratch the surface of what is truth. It's the accountant's truth. It's the bookkeeper's truth. And yet, I have been for years after the question, how can you dig into a very deep stratum of truth, into something inexplicable, something mysterious? And, of course, you can reach it and you can find it, but normally through invention, through imagination, through fabrication, sometimes even contorting and stylizing events right out there. And then all of a sudden, you will find something strange and deep and elusive, and that is a certain truth. And you must not make the mistake to believe that everything in Little Dieter Needs to Fly is the accountant's truth. Much of it has been invented. His dreams are my invention. Or, for example, there's a scene where he tries to explain how death looks like for him. And he's standing in front of a tank with jellyfish in it, a water tank. And he simply tried to explain it to me, what death was looking like for him. And he had no image, and he described it in a way that I immediately figured it was jellyfish slowly moving, almost dancing in a void, and in a slow motion, transparent, strange movement. And that was exactly what was needed. He only couldn't express it, but I had the image for it.
My guest is film director Werner Herzog. You were born in 1942 and grew up in Germany in the very end of the war and in the post-war period. I'm wondering what your early memories are of the war or the post-war period.
I do have clear memories of that time. You have to imagine that when I was born in Munich, only 2 weeks later, a bomb hit the house next to us. And our place was half destroyed, and my mother discovered me, the baby, under a foot of shards of glass and debris. But I was unhurt, but my mother fled to the remotest mountain valley in Bavaria, and we got stuck there. So By the age of 11, I had no idea what a telephone was. I had never seen movies. I'd never seen a TV set. I barely had seen cars in my life. And you may not believe this, but I made my first phone call at the age of 17. But I made my first movie at the age of 19. So that explains a little bit about the background. And of course, I remember the hardships, and I remember that I was hungry as a child and we had nothing to eat and things like this, which was quite all right because I had a wonderful childhood and I wouldn't like to miss that.
Filmmaker Werner Herzog speaking with Terry Gross in 1998. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1998 interview with Werner Herzog. His new feature film is Rescue Dawn.
You are very interested as a filmmaker in unusual and sometimes surrealistic kind of landscapes and extreme landscapes, whether it's, you know, it's the jungle or the desert or a bombed out area. And I'm wondering if you had a lot of visual images like that kind of imprinted in you in the post-war era when Germany was so bombed out.
No, I belong to those Germans who didn't have a childhood image of the post-war Germany, because in this mountain village there was no real warfare. It was just occupied by 60 Americans at the very, very end of the war. It was the last pocket of unoccupied territory when Germany shrank more and more and more. All of a sudden, this was the last remaining unoccupied square mile or whatever. And 60 Americans moved in jeeps and they were totally relaxed, chewing gum. And I had the feeling this was all the Americans of the world. And for the first time, I saw a black man. And I was totally mesmerized by seeing him because I had only heard about black people in fairy tales. And I immediately became friends with him and talked to him for hours. So what I want to say is the climate was not the climate of total destruction that Germany had witnessed all around me. It was a mountain village, a mountain valley, remote and just nature around. And only when I was 11 and the war was well over, I saw destroyed cities and bombed out places. And I developed a concept of what must have happened.
And were you frightened by that concept?
No, not really. It's strange because everybody thinks that German children who grew up in the post-war time had a terrible childhood. In the contrary, nobody was frightened. All my school friends who grew up in the cities, they are delirious about speaking of this time when they grew up in ruins and it was pure anarchy in the best sense of the word. There were no fathers around to tell them what to do and how to do things. They would be the masters and the kings of, let's say, a whole block that was bombed out. And they would, it was the most wonderful playground for children. Or for example, in my case, in this last days of war, some soldiers had fled into this area and had hidden their weapons under the hay or in the forest. And by age 4, age 5, I had a working submachine gun. and fired with it. And I tried to hunt a crow because I wanted to make a soup. I was so hungry. And my mother discovered that, and she was totally calm and explained to us how lethal a weapon like that could be by just demonstrating it, by shooting one single round through a thick log of beech wood. And we were so stunned by the violence and force of such a weapon that we immediately had a clear sense how to behave. And it was just learning by experience. And the childhood of practically all the children who grew up in the post-war time was wonderful, as strange and as paradoxical as it may sound.
Now, you did have a father, I believe, and I think you've described him as someone who was a militant atheist, and at 14 you converted to Catholicism. Was that like in reaction against your father?
I do not believe so, because I grew up without the presence of my father.
Oh, I see.
In other words, my father was away in the war, and then he was prisoner of war and came back a year and a half later and then almost immediately divorced my mother. So I grew up without his presence. I wouldn't say it was a move against an overwhelming father figure. He was simply not there. But at the age of 14, there was a time of extremely lucid moments that I had. I had a very intensive religious urge, and I started to travel on foot. I walked all around the country Albania, always following its borderline. That's exactly Kosovo, where there's all this turmoil right now. But I was only 14 and a child. And at that time, I knew and I decided that my destiny inevitably was to be a poet or be the one who had to make the images, who had to make the films. And I shouldered all this very, very clearly, knowing that it would not be an easy life.
Now, I've read about this walk around Albania when you were a teenager, and I can't say I really understand what motivated you to do something so both extreme and in some ways pointless.
No, it was not pointless, certainly not at that time. And whenever I have traveled on foot, and I've traveled very, very large distances, mm-hmm. It always would have a very intensive, essential reason in my life.
Well, what was the reason with Albania?
It was a deep mystery. There was, in the middle of Europe, a white dot on the map, a country that was totally inaccessible. It was like Tibet in the 50s or 40s, where nobody was allowed to go in. Visas were denied to everyone. And also some sort of a heritage. My mother's family comes from the Balkans. They were actually Croatians. So there were deep reasons behind all these things. I can give you an example which is easier to understand. When I wanted to marry and have children, I could have done it over the phone to propose, or I could have written a letter and propose, or I could have taken a car. But I had the feeling a real man walks to his woman and proposes and asks the questions. And so I crossed the Alps and I walked about 1,000 miles and knocked at the door of my future wife. And in this case, I actually told her that I had come on foot because I had one question to ask, so I asked it. And I think that was the right way to do it. So there was a very existential reason for it.
Werner Herzog, I'd love to talk more. We're out of time. It's really been a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Werner Herzog speaking with Terry Gross in 1998. His new film, Rescue Dawn, is a dramatic retelling of the story from his 1997 documentary, Little Dieter Needs to Fly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Classics edition of The Federalist, papers by Hamilton, Madison, and Jay, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at moma.org. And from The Dial Press, publisher of Uncommon Arrangements, Portraits of Married Life by Katie Royfe. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we look at our healthcare system and discuss the problems and possible solutions with John Oberlander, Associate Professor of Social Medicine and Health Policy and Administration at the University of North Carolina. And we get his critique of Michael Moore's new film, Sicko. Join us for the next Fresh Air.